From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, hot and dry in the central U.S., the president's tax play, Romney meets African Americans and his business history, a cover-up charge at Penn State. In Houston, Mitt Romney told NAACP conventioners they have a choice, that he's the man for Black America.
I submit to you this. If you want a president who will make things better in the African American community, you are looking at him. You take a look.
The Obama campaign jumped all over fresh attention to Governor Romney's Bain Capital years. More of them, reports said, than we knew. Here's the campaign's Stephanie Cutter.
Mitt Romney was in full control of Bain Capital through 2002 and therefore directly responsible for whether it's outsourcing, bankrupting, laying off workers, whatever the consequences of Bain investments are.
And former FBI Director Louis Freeh delivered his report on Penn State, Jerry Sandusky's alleged child sex abuse, and what he called callous and shocking disregard for Sandusky's victims.
The most powerful men at Penn State failed to take any steps for 14 years to protect the children who Sandusky victimized.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of the National Journal, Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Tax Talk, Bain Capital, NAACP. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. From Washington, Brian Monroe joins us today, editor of CNNPolitics.com. Brian, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me again.
From Washington as well, Major Garrett is here, chief White House correspondent for the National Journal. Major, welcome back to you as well.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. How's your capital doing, Jack?
Fine, thank you.
Oh, good. So good to hear it. So glad to hear it. Hey, can we go straight to, speaking of capital, Bain Capital and the whole, it was just a week ago, the economy, the jobs numbers were terrible. President Obama was up against the wall with all the hounding from Republicans and everybody else. And Major Garrett, this week, here come these stories again about how long exactly was Mitt Romney in charge at Bain Capital? Was it longer than he's led the world to believe? And off goes the economy. Back comes the Romney business record. What's up? What's going on here, Major?
It's part of the Obama campaign's concerted and persistent, and I predict continuous effort to disqualify Mitt Romney as an acceptable economic alternative to President Obama. The Obama campaign knows, and every poll reflects this, that there is general dissatisfaction, not intense, but certainly generalized dissatisfaction with the state of the U.S. economy and the president's stewardship of it. So the president's options are twofold. Either try to talk about an economy that people are dissatisfied with and persuade them that they should be happier than they are. They're not going to do that. Or try to disqualify the alternative, Mitt Romney, as someone who could be an acceptable steward of the economic destiny and future of this country. And the Obama campaign has chosen the latter. And Bain Capital is part of a larger matrix of issues the Obama campaign has used and will continue to use all the way to Election Day to tell voters, yes, you may be dissatisfied, but if you pick this other alternative, you're going to be more dissatisfied because either one, Mitt Romney is not credible in his representations to you about his ability to turn around an economy or create jobs. That's what a lot of Bain is about. Because this dispute over when Romney left and effectively gave over control of Bain goes to the heart of what Romney has said about his job-creating agenda and his understanding and appreciation of how the real economy works. What the Obama campaign wants to do is say the things that Mitt Romney doesn't want to talk about in the years after he said he left Bain, a lot of bad things happened. Jobs were outsourced. Companies went bankrupt. Decisions were made that materially harmed the lives of workers, companies Bain invested in. Romney doesn't want any of that to stick to him, so he wants to say, look, I left Bain, went on to take control of the troubled Salt Lake Winter Olympics. Though I had my name on a lot of papers, though I testified about things that saying I had some control and some involvement, it was all arm's length, and I was not an active hour-to-hour, day-to-day, week-to-week participant in Bain decisions. The Obama campaign says there's a paper trail that suggests you were, and we're going to make you own the things that Bain did, even though you said you were a manager in absentia.
Brian Monroe, what about all this on the facts? I mean, we've heard this kind of talk before. It came back this week when the Boston Globe put a very prominent story out there and saying, look, in these SEC filings, here was Mitt Romney for some years after he had said, I'm out of there, as sole stockholder, chairman of the board, chief executive officer, and president of Bain Capital. Now, Romney says, wait a minute, I had a leave of absence. Yes, on paper, maybe, but I was not in charge. How are voters supposed to parse this, Brian?
Well, you know, there are the facts out there, and then there's the political perception. And you're right, the play on the political perception is what's buzzing right now. But here's some of the facts that we know. We've got a piece up right now by our John King that really dissects the Bain in the 1999 year, what they call the Big Bain Lie. And we have talked to several sources up in Boston and elsewhere on the record and on background who all say that by 1999, Romney was out of the picture. He was really not exerting any control over over Bain, besides the paperwork, as you mentioned earlier, including one of them who is a Obama supporter and a Democrat, and also a very close friend of Romney's and very loyal to him. He was quick to admit, but says that, you know, he really didn't have any operational control. But that almost doesn't matter in the play that the Obama campaign's making right now. Even, you know, one of their surrogates went out to suggest that Romney may have even committed a felony by saying one thing on FEC filings and doing another.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's really not much to support that. I know the Globe has a piece talking about points memo has a piece. We have not found anything that supports that line. But what's really happening is they're using it's painting Romney as someone who they don't want to have the Americans believe he has the background to control the economy. But there's also a narrative happening. And that is, Mitt Romney is not like you. He's not like us. He is a rich, elite billionaire who can't relate to your problems, doesn't get the fact that you're out of a job. And that is the narrative that they are hammering. And unfortunately, it's working. It's working in Ohio. It's working in the Rust Belt. We're seeing the numbers from the latest polling really shifting on, particularly on those issues of, do you relate to Mitt Romney? So they're going to stay on this, almost facts be darned.
I mean, I guess there are ways, Jack, in which you just on the facts, you could say Mitt Romney is not like you, just in terms of wealth, for example, compared to most Americans. There was a piece on NPR this morning where David Wellner went out to Bermuda, where Romney had set up this offshore account, and just ran into a corporate finance lawyer there in Bermuda, Stephen Reese Davis, who explained, you know, that there was no problem with somebody like Romney setting up an account in Bermuda. Everybody does it, he said. Let's listen to the sort of a lawyer to the rich talking about how that works.
Why would you operate in a certain manner and pay a certain amount of tax when legally you could just change that, do something differently, and pay less tax? So why would you buy bottles of Gosling's rum at duty-free when you leave the country, when you could go and buy it at Front Street and pay full duty for it? Why do we do that? Well, because we get it duty-free. Everybody does it.
Everybody does it. And we're really talking here about, you know, offshore accounts, Jack. And then years worked here and there. Brian says they've looked into it. In fact, Mitt had, unbuckled from Bain Capital. But there's his name on the paperwork, and the Obama drumbeat goes on.
Yes, I've got to take a call, excuse me, Tom, from my Swiss banker here.
Oh, yeah. No,
everybody, everybody does it. Well, you know, that's an ethic that is part of it. It shows something about our society. People have contrasted the ethic of the days of George Romney Sr. when he paid at 36%. He divulged all his in 12 years of tax history and so on. Norms have changed. But it's very hard to explain to people who aren't able to avail themselves of the relief of Bermuda. You know, there's a reason no political party has ever nominated someone like Mitt Romney, a businessman who makes this the cynosure of his campaign. I'm a businessman. That's why you should be elect me. That's not happened. I mean, yes, we've had businessmen run. Herbert Hoover would be the closest case. Mm-hmm. But there were 15 years of government service that supervened between between his business career and his running for president. This is something new, and there's nothing wrong with being a businessman. It's just that, you know, when you start to look at the details of anybody's big business career, inevitably something comes up. Under today's rules, St. Francis of Assisi would have trouble, you know, making a clear run for president.
Did he have Cayman Island accounts,
yeah,
too,
Jack? Oh, he
everybody
had all sorts. Yeah, sure.
All the saints had him. Here, let's hear from the president. Here he was talking with Charlie Rose. It's just airing this morning, I guess, saying, well, talking about how, you know, this isn't this business background was not about creating jobs.
As I said, when some people questioned why I would challenge his Bain record, the point I made there in the past is if you're a head of a large private equity firm or hedge fund, your job is to make money. It's not to create jobs.
Major Garrett, do you think is this a closed door, a closed book on the facts of it, or are people going to continue looking into, you know, whether or not, okay, he was out in Salt Lake working on the Olympics, but was he on the phone back to his headquarters in Boston saying, well, what about this or that business deal?
The Obama campaign believes, and they have a considerable treasure trove of focus group experience to build this theory around, that when they tell people in order, in sort of sequence, well, if you knew that Mitt Romney did X, Y, and Z, and let's put actual facts that they give to their focus group attendees behind X, Y, and Z, that he owned a Swiss bank account, that he had a Bermuda corporation, that he was at Bain and on Bain's legal documents and SEC representations
and
longer than he has represented.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right. What does that tell you about Romney? What happens in these focus groups is people either undecided or nominally in favor of Romney begin to harden in their opposition. The Obama campaign understands this insight, intends to use this as a larger narrative, as Brian said, to disqualify him as an acceptable alternative.
We're going to hear more on this front, but there's a lot pushing against the president as well. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, fresh questions over Romney's business career, Obama on taxes, a cover-up charged at Penn State on Sandusky, and of course, the child sex abuse there. Brian Monroe, editor of CNNPolitics.com, is with us. Major Garrett, White House correspondent for the National Journal, is here. Jack Beatty is in the house. You can join us as well. Here was Mitt Romney with some charges of his own this week, telling supporters at a town hall meeting in Grand Junction, Colorado, that President Obama was to blame for the outsourcing of American jobs.
This president has been outsourcing a good deal of American jobs himself by putting money into energy companies, solar and wind energy companies, that end up making their products outside the United States. If there's an outsourcer in chief, it's the president of the United States, not the guy who's running to replace him.
All right, there's Mitt Romney, outsourcer in chief, he says to the president. Brian Monroe, I don't know how you've been running your fact checking on this point, but I've seen a lot of the companies that were involved in this saying, no, that's not us. What about it? Outsourcer in chief.
Well, you know, it continues this, you know, for lack of a better word, he said narrative, and that they're pushing back on each other almost by a playbook. Here's what we've seen so far. The companies that the Romney campaign are mentioning, many of them, while there were some foreign investments, have actual operations in the United States, in the Carolinas and elsewhere, where the jobs and the people who were hired to reflect on some of the opportunities created by stimulus were Americans. And so it kind of falls apart in many of the fronts. That said, it's playing defense against the original attacks from Obama against Romney on his Bain investments and others that lost jobs and the outsourcing area. So this is the bigger issue here is I think for many Americans, they're getting tired of this. They're tuning out. Mm-hmm. We've seen that, and we had a poll recently that showed that most Americans are already in July fed up with this election. And that's going to be a bigger issue on turnout. And, you know, so this is not just a energize your base vote. And I think stories like this and he said, he says like this are making people tune out.
There's a lot of looking backward here. Let's hear from our listeners what they think of what's unfolding. Shopville, Kentucky. Don is calling in. Hi, Don. Thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I've been hearing a lot of talk about Romney. Was he in charge? Was he not in charge? Look, I could care less. All I know is it's 8.2 unemployment right now. In my state, it's worse. Mines in East Kentucky are shutting down. West Virginia's shutting down. Virginia's shutting down. Serious problem. I know people have been out of work for 3 years. This guy's been in charge for 3-4 years. It's not working out. That's all I got to say.
Pink slip for the president.
I'm not really worried about the Smith. Yes, the president of the United States.
Don, we've got it. The unemployment's bad. Let's look forward. And you're putting it on Obama and saying enough already, and I appreciate your call. One more right here. Woodward, Iowa. Danielle.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am very concerned to have a business person in charge of the country. We had one in G.W. Bush, and look what he did. He tanked the economy. He put us into horrific wars. Romney beats the drum of war with his talk about China. I think he would be a disaster.
What about our caller Don from Kentucky just now? He looks around at the unemployment rate. He says President Obama has had his time at bat here, and it hasn't worked out. Time to change.
I think when you're trying to revive a tanked economy, it takes more than 3 years to do that. And I'm middle class. I'm upper middle class. My parents are upper middle class.
Okay.
I trust Michelle Obama. She's like me. She's a middle-class person. I think Obama had a largely middle-class upbringing, but he had a lot of trauma in his life. I'm counting on Michelle to keep the president honest, and I think she's a force to be reckoned with.
Danielle, we've got it loud and clear. Let me get one more, if I may. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You'd think by now that politicians would understand that when they try to draw Americans' conclusions for them, it usually backfires. In 73, Nixon said, "I am not a crook," but Americans concluded that he was. In 92, George Bush said, "Message, I care," but Americans concluded that he didn't. This week, Mitt Romney said, "I have no hidden agenda," but now we find that he filed statements with the SEC saying he was CEO and president of Bain 3 years after he said he left. And the forms even say it was his principal employment. His defense is that he was CEO in name only, and Bain paid him more than $100,000 a year for doing nothing. Now, the Beltway media and the fact-checkers are parsing whether or not Mitt Romney personally laid off Americans and shipped their jobs to China, but they're missing the forest for the trees. Because whether it's undisclosed tax returns, purged emails, secret Swiss bank accounts, or SEC filings that don't mean what they say, Americans are concluding that all Mitt Romney has are hidden agendas.
Mark, we got it. Major Garrett, let me come to you. What does Romney do with this? What about tax returns?
By the way, I think if the Obama campaign were listening to that call, they would record Mark's commentary
lay it back across
and
the
turn
country.
It around into a 30-second ad in about 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, who knows? What about those tax returns?
Mark, you may be getting a phone call. Keep your phone line open.
Listen, his dad put a lot out there when he was running for office. Mitt has just gone back a year or two. Is that a
1 year on the record? He says the second year, meaning this present tax year, will be available when it's done. So
right.
Only 1 year on the record so far. Yes.
Why not take it back further? Just, you know, open it up and say, okay, here it is. Could that help settle all this down?
I think Mark is on to something that's very important. And reporters are required to parse and look carefully and compare and contrast and take statements. And I would say that the Obama campaign would be wise not to drop the word felony so casually. That's an enormously important and incendiary charge, and if you can't back it up, that's something you ought not to say in a
relation
campaign,
to misrepresenting on an SEC form.
Right, your credibility. Mm-hmm. But the larger point for Romney is he wants to say, you're dissatisfied with the economy, come to me, trust me. Well, trust is measured and adjudicated in many ways in a political campaign in this country. And one of the ways is, what is your story? What is your narrative? And the story for Mitt Romney has many holes in it because he will not talk openly and transparently about his economic life and his own economic story. And I think the Obama campaign has onto something by forcing Romney to go to a place he'd rather not go. And he gave John McCain more than 20 years of tax returns when he was being vetted as a potential running mate. His father set a standard. Mm-hmm. Others have set a more comprehensive standard of transparency on this. And if the Romney campaign refuses to do what others have done before, many voters may ask themselves, is he telling us that the truth is worse than all the criticism and grief he's living with? And if so, I'll draw my own conclusion about how bad that truth might be.
Yeah, but up against all that, Jack, let me drop a little tape in here from Governor Romney. Up against all that is Governor Romney speaking to the kind of sentiment we heard from Don in Kentucky, who says, look, say what you will, this economy is bad, and he's not confident that the president will turn it around. Mitt Romney took that even to the NAACP this week. He told the crowd there that, you know, equal opportunity is still not achieved, and he said, even within your own ranks, there are serious, honest debates about the way forward. Here he is in Houston.
Instead, it's worse for African Americans in almost every way. The unemployment rate, the duration of unemployment, average income, median family wealth are all worse in the black community.
Just laying it down there for African Americans, but you could take that, you know, wider than that, Jack. There are current facts as well.
Oh, yes. And, you know, we would be talking about Don's point, this terrible economy, the disappointment in the president because of it. We'd be talking about economic retrospective voting, which is essentially what political scientists say decides elections. Am I better off than I was 4 years ago? That would be our subject this week if it weren't for all these return of the repressed from the Romney business career. And this was the risk in nominating Romney. The Republicans knew it. It was partially litigated in the primaries. There were those charges of vulture capitalism and all the rest, and they took a chance. And you know, I've seen pieces that say, well, was Mitt Romney vetted? And as Major said, has he in fact vetted himself? After all, they only had 4 years to prepare for this and to allay any doubts on these questions. And you know, this interval of 3 or 4 years that he's signing the SEC documents, but he's not really running the company. Well, that matters because 6,000 people, according to one estimate, lost their jobs in companies that went bankrupt. Bain, you know, obtained companies in that interval. And Mr. Romney has said that the Obama people are lying when they charge him with, a particular case in, I think, a Kansas City. But and they cite a Washington Post fact check for that. But subsequent Washington Post reporting has said, no, he is an outsourcer. And here's the evidence. It muddies an already turbid water for Mr. Romney.
Brian, Major, I want to ask, well, I'm sorry, was that you, Major, Brian?
No, it was Brian.
Yeah. Please, what do you say?
Well, you know, I think going back to the forest for the trees comment I think mm-hmm. Mark made earlier, mm-hmm. Whether or not Mitt Romney was the CEO in 1999 and the things that, you know, he said he was, there's no doubt about that. And whether he had direct control over the company mm-hmm. almost doesn't matter. He, you know, he created this company. He was their sole shareholder mm-hmm. for quite a while. And, you know, just think common sense. You're running a company, excuse me, and you've got a culture you've created, a way of doing things, a way of looking at investments, weighing risk and benefits, and a team of very smart investors who are reflecting that culture you have created. You think it's going to change on a dime when you leave?
You fly out to Salt Lake, it's going to glide on. Yeah. No,
and one thing in particular is coming up is John points out there's an investment that happened in November of 1999 that I am sure the Obama campaign is going to bring out, and that's called Stericycle. It was a medical waste company that, among other things, allegedly disposed of aborted fetuses.
Okay.
That's going to come out.
Okay.
And that's going to be you. And so that's why the 1999 timeline. Was he in control in November or February? Did he have anything to do with it? Was it his culture that did investments like this? That's why the timing is important in this narrative.
Important to think about history here. At the same time, I and presumably many voters as well hope we're really thinking about the future as well. I want to ask you, Brian Major, about this moment. It was in Houston. It kind of, I guess, it looked like a pretty deliberate in-your-face moment when Governor Romney addressed the NAACP. You'll hear that moment and the booing that followed. Here's Governor Romney.
If our goal is jobs, we have to stop spending over $1 trillion more than we take in every year. And so to do that, I'm going to eliminate every non-essential expensive program I can find. That includes Obamacare. And I'm going to work to reform and save.
...14 seconds of booing. There had been applause. There was definitely applause. But, Brian, I'll come to you. But, Major Garrett, first to you, what did you see in that moment? Is this a deliberate stagecraft, or what's happening there?
Certainly. And it's not people have described it to me on talk radio. Well, he was trying to really rev up the base. No, he wasn't trying to rev up the base. He was trying to reassure the base and take a message that he knew would be uncomfortable for members of the NAACP to hear, that they would probably react to in some way or another. He may not have expected booing of that duration, but I'm sure he expected some kind of negative audible reaction. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of saying, I'll take my message consistently everywhere I go, even into places that I know it won't be well received, because I believe it, I'm committed to it, and I'm telling you who disagree with me, I'm committed to it. Most importantly, I'm telling those who are on my side but who may have some doubts and harbor some reservations about me, I am fully committed to this. Have no fear. Don't worry. This is the path I'm going
to
go down.
Brian, what do you make of that moment? I mean, it's not as if Mitt Romney hasn't been crystal clear that he would work to repeal Obamacare, as he puts it. He's said that again and again and again, but this moment's gotten a lot of attention.
Well, I think Major's absolutely right. He was this play was not to the African-Americans sitting in that room or members of NAACP. This was to white suburban voters to reassure them that, you know, he's going to be tough when he has to be tough. Whether or not that worked, we'll see. But it was striking. And I was sitting there watching this when it happened. And I've been to this convention many times. I have never seen any politician, particularly a candidate for president or a president, be booed. Especially for 15 seconds. We sat there and clocked it. We rewound the tape and clocked it again.
Was that bad form? Was that uncivil behavior? Or was Romney somehow, you know, out of bounds and getting sort of in people's face there? What do you think?
I think it's both. You know, that audience is not afraid to have an emotional reaction to anything. And so he definitely hit a hot button. And in fact, he actually got booed two other times during the speech as well. You know, I will certainly give him his props for showing up. Obama didn't. Biden, mm-hmm. He sent Biden in his stead, and he had a taped message before Biden spoke. And you know, there are supporters of Obama who said that, you know, look, he's not taking the black vote for granted. He kind of rotates through conventions. He's doing the Urban League this year. He did another convention last year. Yeah. He did NAACP the year before. I was the chair of the Unity Journalists of Color Convention in 2008, where mm-hmm. we invited both he and John McCain. McCain did not show up. Obama did. We've actually invited both Obama and Romney to the current convention in a couple weeks in Vegas, and haven't gotten confirmations from either of them yet. But showing up for this crowd was an important thing.
Yep, and Mitt Romney did it. The vice president, as you say, showed up yesterday. Here he was, Joe Biden, defending President Obama's health care reform, and the president.
He prevailed where no president had done before. He was right. He was right. It cut $100 billion from the federal debt over the next 10 years, providing access to affordable health care to 30 million Americans, 8 million black Americans who would never have had insurance.
There's the vice president appealing for that black vote, and it's the opposite of booing there right then. Jack, what do you make of this week and this voting population is represented at the NAACP?
Well, it's not going to go to Mitt Romney, not even he's probably not even going to improve on John McCain's, 4 or 5%?
Yeah, something like that.
But clearly this was a way to get, he wanted to get some reaction to what he said. He used the provocative phrase Obamacare, and he got the reaction he wanted. What bothered me in particular was the next day, I think, talking to a white audience in Montana, he seemed to be reviving stereotypes of almost charged racial stereotypes when he said, well, these people seem to want free stuff. And when I'm president, they're not going to get free stuff. You know, that's not so far from the welfare queen. That's not really so far from that. And I thought that was a low point for Mr. Romney.
It is kind of interesting. There's a meme sort of cartoon making the rounds on the web now about Mitt Romney with a big laugh on his face scolding the NAACP for free stuff. And underneath it says, Mitt Romney, it says, got a $77,000 tax credit for his pet horse last year. I guess that's Anne's dressage horse there. Well, you know, we've all got our irons in the fire, I guess. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Asperger. This is On Point. In other news this week, cash-strapped Scranton, Pennsylvania made headlines when the mayor cut 400 city workers' pay, including his own, to minimum wage. $7.25 an hour, Firefighters Union President John Judge was lit up.
I have firefighters running into burning buildings at 7.25, and there's police officers fighting with criminals wrestling in the street. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Punishing heat and the worst drought in a quarter century hitting crops in the Midwest hard, Bob Bluer, a corn and soybean farmer in northern Illinois, said he's worried his crop will be very meager.
If this is our end harvest, I hate to get into the unemployment rolls, but we'll go to town and find a job and try to do something else to make ends meet. That's all you can do.
That's all you can do. Everybody looking at the weather and the climate this week. And Roger Federer comes back to take Wimbledon for the seventh time, defeating Britain's Andy Murray in the final match.
It's Federer again for a seventh time as Roger reclaims his Wimbledon title and the number one ranking back on top of tennis.
We're looking at a week in the news, questions on Romney's business background, Obama on taxes, a cover-up charge at Penn State on Jerry Sandusky. I said alleged earlier, but of course it's not that. It is child abuse there, and plenty of it from Louis Freeh's report. A lot of talk in the House of Representatives this week about a government takeover of health care as the vote was put once again to repeal. Speaking on the floor of the House, here's Texas Republican Congressman Francisco Canseco.
Obamacare is still a government takeover of health care, putting federal bureaucrats in charge of decisions that should be made by you and your doctor by creating 159 different boards, bureaucracies, and programs that will increase Washington's control over health care.
Democrats fighting back. Here's the Democratic Congressman Steve Israel with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell saying what the effect he thought of Americans would be if the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare, were to be repealed.
It is the Republicans' priorities to take away patient protections, tell women that if they have breast cancer, it is once again a pre-existing condition, tell children that they're now kicked out of their health insurance plan, their parents' health insurance plans, tell middle-class consumers that once again there are things like lifetime caps, and tell seniors that they're going to have to pay more for prescription drug care.
Brian Monroe with CNNPolitics.com is here. Major Garrett of the National Journal, our own Jack Beatty, will come to them. Listeners, what do you think on this front? Arthur in Corbin, Kentucky. Arthur, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. You know, this whole healthcare debacle, nightmare kind of thing. First of all, people have to understand, I don't care who gets up there as a presidential candidate and spews this garbage about, first thing I'm going to do is repeal Obamacare. Okay, let's understand that the president does not have the authority to repeal anything. This would take an actual act of Congress to repeal Obamacare or any other piece of legislation. This is an act of Congress, period. And unless you have an overwhelming majority committed to this, and I would recommend that the only way you could guarantee this to take place would be for everyone who to sign a pledge saying that we will vote to repeal it.
But Arthur, you know a lot of Republicans are very happy to sign that pledge, and it's exactly the rallying cry. They're trying to take the Congress to do exactly that.
Exactly. But what I'd like to see is I'd like to see them take it one step further. And what I would like to see is there's a unique power that each state has. It's called the power of nullification. Some states have already done this, saying that Obamacare will not come into our states. Every single state needs to do this on a state level. Now, if you get every single state to nullify Obamacare, guess what? It doesn't apply. There is no mandate. And it doesn't matter what the president or Congress says, they cannot enforce it.
Arthur, we've got it. It clearly is still a hot-button issue here. Major Garrett, how do you see this one moving on through the campaign into the fall? Brian says people are checking out of the campaign, but there's still a lot of passion around this issue.
There's a lot of passion around this issue. And the Obama campaign, when the Supreme Court decision was handed down, there was a briefing for many of us who cover the White House, and the senior advisors present there made it clear to us that they would take the decision that it was constitutional, sort of pack it into the president's speech right where it always has been on the stump, meaning they were not going to elevate or further dramatize the president's role or his point of pride in passing health care reform. It would be exactly the same place, kind of back third of his campaign stump speech, which tells me the Obama campaign
wants to focus on the economy, wants to focus on the disqualification of Romney, wants to focus on a hardened debate over taxation, whose taxes are raised, whose taxes stay the same, and not emphasize health care. Republicans want to put health care in the sort of second locomotive behind the first locomotive of criticism against President Obama, which is about his economic stewardship. But say, secondarily, one of the reasons the economy is underperforming is because of the vast level of uncertainty about the regulations and taxes that will come when the health care reform law is fully implemented starting in 2014. So this will be a consistent, visible part of the Republican campaign against the president, less so for the president, as he says, I deserve a second term.
Brian, lots of Democrats complaining this week, waste of time when it came to this vote. Now, you could point that finger at any number of things, I guess. But to a lot of voters, still not a waste of time.
Well, you know, this is the 33rd time they voted on health care and voted to repeal it. Here are some folks. We talked to a guy in South Dakota who he was a doctor in a small town of about 1,000 people. And he says, he's tired of it. His name's Thomas Dean. He said, it's complicated and easy to manipulate and easily demagogue. I'm tired of politics. And we're hearing that all over the place, that particularly on health care, it's now settled law. And some folks just want to move on. But Major's right that this will continue to be the second most powerful issue to get the conservative base riled up and get them out to vote, just the promise of it. But the caller earlier who said that it's not just the Republican-controlled House voting 33 times to repeal mm-hmm. Obamacare. It's got to go through the Senate, and it's got to be signed by the president. And right now, neither one of those things is going to happen.
Well,
and it's going to take the Republicans to win all three of those branches in November to have any chance of making it happen in the future.
Of course, the right now is what it's all about, and Republicans hoping to use voter concern over that to drive exactly that kind of victory. Settled law only unless and until it's really repealed. Speaking of political theater, maybe more than that, the president speaking on Monday in Washington outlining his tax goals, tax policy, saying he would extend the Bush tax cuts, but only for the middle class.
We need policies that grow and strengthen the middle class, policies that help create jobs, that make education and training more affordable, that encourage businesses to start up and create jobs right here in the United States. So that's why I believe it's time to let the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, folks like myself, to expire.
Jack Meaney, take on the president and tax policy this week. Governor Romney wants all the tax cuts to go forward. The president says, well, yes, up to $250,000, and then for a year extend them for the middle class. Is this also just posturing, Jack, or real deal?
Well, the Financial Times editorialized, they called it a gimmick because, of course, it's a way to get Republicans to vote against a tax cut for the middle class because it won't pass. The president's bill wouldn't pass.
Well, can't get it through the Senate.
Can't get it through the Senate and much less the House. So it's an effort to just get them on the record and use that against them in the fall campaign. If I were an editor of a newspaper, I would now have my people investigating this. It may be, and Major can talk about this, but weeks ago there was talk that senators of both parties were getting together and saying, look, Taxmageddon is coming up. We really have to deal with this. We have to start talking about it now, preparing now for all the bad things that are going to happen at the end of the year, and start to work out a deal. I think the president's speech might have made that deal harder to get. This has happened before with Mr. Obama. He has made a speech which has essentially made it impossible for Republicans. Once he makes the speech, it's polarized. He makes it impossible for Republicans to come over. And something like that may have happened here.
Major, how about a Taxmageddon, end of the year, all kinds of budget consequences? How is that shaping up? And what's the strategy here from the White House point of view?
Two quick points. Jack is right. The president's speech did make it harder, but the president's speech is built on a foundation of analysis the White House has done that whatever conversations we're having, and they were embryonic conversations among bipartisan senators to try to deal with or at least theoretically talk about dealing with the fiscal cliff before the lame duck session after the November election. And one thing happened in that meeting, and I've written about this at National Journal. Joe Lieberman, who's leaving the Senate, stood up and said, is there anyone in this room, there are about 25 senators from both parties, willing to stand up and talk about this who's running for re-election this year? Dead silence.
Wow.
All right? Nobody running this year would be willing to stand up and say anything
about confronting this earlier, meaning before the election. The White House knows this. They know it's a, dead letter, and they're not going to worry about giving a speech that might suffocate what they know is a dead initiative in the first place. I wrote this week in my column, it's on the website now, that one thing our country needs to reconcile itself to is this. The president extended the Bush tax cuts in toto for 2 years. He wants to extend three-quarters of them for another year. The opening line of my column was, can we start calling the Bush tax cuts the Obama tax cuts now? Because essentially, the president has embraced much of those tax cuts as they relate to marginal rates. We have had 12 years of the Bush tax cuts, in addition to 2.5 years of the president's own payroll tax cuts, make work pay tax cuts, and tax credits for people trying to find jobs or alleviate college tuition. And the economy is still stuck. What we need is a fundamental and rational, and perhaps that's asking too much, debate about what our tax code does, doesn't do, and why it is vastly underperforming as a matter of fiscal stimulus, what the Kennedy tax cuts did in the 1960s and the Reagan tax cuts did in the 1980s. You look at the wage growth after those tax cuts and job growth compared to the Bush years and the Obama years, they're light years apart. Our economy is in a different place, and until we fundamentally change our tax code to reflect those changes, we're going to be having the same stale, though marginally politically interesting debate, but we're not going to turn the economy around.
And those issues of revenue and spending really pressing right up and down from the national right down to the local levels. We saw there in Scranton this week. Rich in Ware, Massachusetts. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show as always.
Thank you.
Major Garrett's right on target. And my point is the Scranton, PA point about the municipal workers there, especially the police and fire workers there. I got to tell you, Tom, I've been dealing with this for 30 years as a union official. These tax-limiting policies have to come to a head. And in my opinion, the only way to bring it to a head is it's easy for me to say this because I'm not working in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Those people have to strike. And they have to strike at a very critical moment when there's going to be lives on the line. Because you cannot force these politicians, both local, state, or federal, to do anything involving taxes. You can't limit the flow of taxes to these direct services for 30 years without consequences. And the only people feeling the consequences are the people that the services are delivered to and the people that are delivering the service.
But, Rich, what about the taxpayers who say, sorry, we just can't pay more in this bad economy?
Now, you know, that's the problem. The problem is, obviously, the same thing that Major was talking about with jobs being limited for 30 years. Quality jobs, quality pay. You cannot have middle-class jobs leaving this country for 30 years and expect not to have a problem in your tax base. If people were working, there needs to be more stimulus, obviously. You can't be laying off these municipal workers because they provide a lot of stimulus to the economy. You have a never-ending cycle here. You're going to cut these wages. Less taxes are going to be paid. You're going to hurt a lot of these municipal workers physically. Deaths, police, and fire. There's understaffing everywhere.
Richard, we've got it. And everybody trying to figure out what to do about that whole cycle to make the whole thing work. San Bernardino going bankrupt this week in California. Here's the mayor out there, Pat Morris, saying it will force the city to reevaluate how it conducts, well, just about everything.
We've got to go back to the game board and reconfigure ourselves. That's my view. We can no longer afford to do it in the traditional way.
Can't do it in the traditional way in several cities in California now, not to mention what has become apparently routine in the world of finance. Still a lot of talk this week about LIBOR and how interest rates were manipulated in London and around the world. That also with municipal consequences. And maybe a big legal tale, Baltimore is suing more than a dozen major banks, claiming that those institutions conspired to manipulate the London interbank offered rate, LIBOR. Here's Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake telling CBS News that funds lost because of manipulated interest rates by bankers looking to profit, were crucial to the city.
You're talking about $1 or $2 million. That, you know, that's a fire company, that's recreation centers, that's, you know, services that our city needs, and we're going to fight for that.
They're going to fight for it in the courts. Major Garrett, Barclays Bank said, okay, yeah, we were doing that, but they're apparently not the only ones. And now there's a whole lot of people lining up to file suit. I mean, this thing could go on for years. Is this the thing that changes the way banks have done business, Major?
I think it very well could be. I think this could be the proverbial, and it's a cliche and I hate to resort to it, but the straw that broke the camel's back on the sense of international finance and the lack of transparency within these very small, largely unknown mechanisms that set interest rates or do things from a regulatory or interest-bearing basis that the larger group of municipal investors, county investors, state investors, or individual investors don't know anything about and don't feel they have any sense of visibility or proximity to. Those things are going to have to change because lawsuits will force accountability and criminal charges may result also from some of this behavior. And it seems to me that when you look at California, for example, I grew up in California. Mm-hmm. Proposition 13 changed the way that California taxes itself and taxes property. In some instances, when I talk about tax reform, you don't need to necessarily in every case raise more revenue. You just have to raise it differently. And what California did 35 years ago was stop using property tax increases to fund everything it was going to do. Well, the revenue was collected in different ways, often economically injurious ways. And yet California, even with a Democratic governor and Democratic legislature, will not revisit Proposition 13. It is shackled to this decision it made almost 40 years ago to unhinge its local communities and its state from property tax revenue. Those kind of decisions have long-running consequences. They've got to be revisited.
Watch this space and the LIBOR scandal in particular. Hey, Brian Maurer, any insight on Jesse Jackson Jr.? What's going on there?
You know, that's a sad story. I know Jesse very well, and you know, we're all praying for him to get better. But the silence and the scrutiny that's happening in Chicago, when you know Dick Durbin came out on Monday saying, you know, he's got to come clean, that was a big shot across the bow to the Jackson family. You know,
Emotional problems, they're saying, yeah, maybe physical as well, as all kinds of gossip. Anybody know?
Yeah, they've said it's mood disorders. I know Jesse had gastric bypass surgery several years ago, and I don't know if any of that has to do with it.
Well, we hope that works out. I'm afraid we're out of time right there. Brian Maurer with CNNPolitics.com, Major Garrett with the National Journal, our own Jack Beatty will be watching. Thanks very much, listeners, for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.